Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories along with Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny has been released after thousands turned out to protest the upcoming March presidential elections. I'm free, Navalny wrote on Twitter late Sunday. He added, "Today has been an important day. We have shown that not all Russia is ready to accept the monarchy. Thanks to all those who were not afraid to fight for their rights." Police arrested Navalny while he was on his way to a rally in central Moscow. The protests were part of a nationwide voters' strike called by Navalny. The opposition leader has been banned from running for president over legal problems. The move was seen as an attempt to keep him out of the race. Vladimir Milov, an advisor for Navalny, told VOA, "We demand a real contest." He said that even supporters of Russian President Vladimir Putin questioned why Navalny is not permitted to participate in the election. He added, "They believe Putin can beat Navalny, and we believe Navalny can beat Putin. That's what elections are all about." Navalny and his supporters have called for a boycott of the election. They argue that a low number of voters will diminish a Putin victory, but it will prove that the government inflates his approval ratings. Organizers said that protests took place in over 100 cities across Russia. OVD Info, a police monitoring group, reported 340 people had been detained nationwide. In Moscow, police also stormed Navalny's anti-corruption foundation and cut an online video feed of the day's protests. Most of the protesters were younger Russians in their teens and early 20s. Ivan Savin is a high school student who attended the rally. He said, "The authorities are used to thinking that Russians will just sit quietly and wait for change. Well, our generation won't wait. We want a better life." He also admitted to telling his parents he was out with friends for the day rather than out protesting the Russian president. His classmate, Valery Koltsov, said that other friends felt the same way. "I know a lot of people who don't come because it really does scare them. They think they'll get fined for not doing what the government tells them," she said. Television host Sinya Sobchak is running in the election against Putin. She asked the anti-Putin forces to voice their anger by supporting her against all candidacy. But Navalny's supporters have called her campaign a Kremlin trick to make the election appear fair. In Moscow, Ludmila Sirodova, a veteran of the massive pro-democracy movement of the late Soviet period, argued real change required a much larger movement. She was among hundreds of thousands who once demanded change and suggested a new generation could learn from that history. She said, "I wish they'd understand that we did what we could. Maybe it wasn't always enough, but now it depends on them. Whatever life they decide they want is the life they'll have."
For much of U.S. history, the American military fighting force was mostly white and male. But today, the force is as diverse as the country it serves to protect. Fort Bragg, in the state of North Carolina, is home to the All-American 82nd Airborne. It calls itself the most diverse division in the United States. And the unit's soldiers say that, despite racial problems within the country, its values remain unchanged. Lieutenant Colonel Joe Buccino is communications director for the 82nd Airborne. He says the unit was the first racially integrated unit in the U.S. Department of Defense. It was also the first division to have women infantry commanders and the first to be organized with people from all over the country. The base has paratroopers from all 50 states, with more than 120 nationalities. Private First Class Irvin Andrian grew up in Indonesia before moving to the eastern U.S. state of Pennsylvania as a teenager. He joined the Army as a mechanic. He says he has never felt out of place. "When I first got here, they all welcomed me," Andrian said, "like they never treated me differently." Sergeant Celine Uribe grew up in the United States, but English was not her first language. She says joining the U.S. Army required making some changes. Coming from a very small town, which is Richgrove, California, 99.9% Hispanic, it was a culture shock, she said. Uribe and others in the unit say they welcome the differences within their division. They also say they have grown from working with people with different life experiences. Specialist Vince Vest said, "I've met some very amazing people, and it's opened my eyes a lot. And I've gained a lot of wisdom through those people, and I've made lifelong friends." Out in the civilian world, the United States is in the middle of a political debate over immigration and racism. Some of the debate has been fueled by controversial remarks made by President Trump. The soldiers at Fort Bragg say they have not experienced racial discrimination in the military. Yet Master Sergeant Jose Colon worries about the day he retires and returns to non-military life. "I don't see any camaraderie in the civilian world coming," he said. Colon says the 82nd and the whole U.S. Army has an established code of conduct that does not permit racism. "You feel safe in some aspects by being in the military, because you have these rules that help protect you and make it equal," he said. "That's why I love it. That's kind of the reason why I joined." As the political debate over immigration continues, the Army continues to welcome recruits from all over the world.
The United States and several other nations are reporting higher rates of the flu compared with past seasons. American health officials say the winter outbreak is expected to be one of the most severe in 15 years, with up to 34 million people infected. Across the U.S., 1 in 15 doctor visits last week were related to the flu, the highest level since the 2009 swine flu pandemic. Before that outbreak, the last time the U.S. experienced such high levels of seasonal flu was in 2003-2004. The U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, said last week that flu cases are currently active in all U.S. states except for Hawaii. All remaining 49 states have reported widespread flu activity for the past 3 weeks. Officials say most U.S. cases of the flu, also called influenza, involve the H3N2 flu virus, the same kind mainly seen last winter. The CDC said the flu has caused nearly 12,000 hospitalizations and killed 37 children. The CDC does not track adult flu deaths directly. But the highest hospitalization rates have been among people 65 years and older. Flu is a contagious illness that causes such symptoms as fever, cough, headaches, and tiredness. Most people who catch the flu get better within a week or two. But some people develop more serious conditions caused by an infection involving the nose, throat, or lungs. The flu season is usually highest in February, and officials say activity has already begun to slow in some parts of the U.S. The CDC recommends a flu vaccine for everyone older than 6 months. But officials said this year's vaccine is only about 30% effective in preventing infection. In Asia, North and South Korea have reported separate outbreaks of different strains of influenza. The rise in cases comes less than 2 weeks before thousands of visitors from around the world arrive for the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Olympics in the South. North Korea's Ministry of Public Health reported more than 80,000 confirmed cases of the influenza strain H1N1 between December 1, 2017 and January 16, 2018. The Red Cross said North Korean health officials reported 3 children and 1 adult have died so far in the outbreak. In the South, officials announced last weekend they discovered a serious strain of the H5N6 avian influenza on a chicken farm near Seoul. About 500,000 chickens and 450,000 eggs were to be destroyed at farms where the virus was found. In Japan, the health ministry reported flu cases reached a record high 2.83 million cases last week. The average number of patients per medical facility was 52, Japan's Kyoto News Agency reported. This is the highest number since such data was first collected in 1999. The ministry said the illness hit children and young people especially hard, with more than 100 schools closed. I'm Brian Lynn. ¶¶
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember in Washington. Last time, we talked about the presidency of John Tyler. The future of Texas was a major issue in American politics in the early 1840s. Texas had declared its independence from Mexico in 1836. Now some Americans wanted the new Republic of Texas to become a U.S. state. But others wanted Texas to remain independent. The Republic of Texas permitted slavery. Americans who opposed Texas statehood wanted to keep an equal balance between slaveholding and non-slaveholding states. President Tyler wanted to make Texas a state. Tyler was a Southerner. He supported slavery and wanted Texas to keep the system legal. The president also had political reasons for wanting Texas to join the Union. He wanted to show that he increased the size and power of the United States during his presidency. He hoped Texas statehood would win him a nomination for a second term as president. So Tyler asked his new Secretary of State, John C. Calhoun, to negotiate the annexation of Texas. On April 12, 1844, Calhoun and Texas officials agreed the territory would enter the Union. They said the new state of Texas could continue slavery. But Britain objected. A British official sent a note saying that Britain wished to end slavery wherever it existed, including Texas. Secretary Calhoun's reply to Britain went public. He defended slavery in the American South. He said what was called slavery was really a political institution necessary for the peace, safety, and economic strength of those states where it existed. Ending slavery in Texas, he said, would be a danger to the American South and to the Union itself. Many people in northern states rejected Calhoun's reasoning. They called on their senators to vote against accepting Texas. But President Tyler continued with his effort to take control of Texas. He sent Calhoun's agreement with Texas to the U.S. Senate for approval. Soon after, the Whig Party opened its national convention to nominate a candidate for president. As expected, the Whigs did not choose President Tyler. They nominated Senator Henry Clay instead. Clay had been working hard to win the nomination. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention a month later. Many Democrats wanted former President Martin Van Buren to be their candidate. But the convention took a surprising turn. The Democrats approved a rule that a candidate must receive at least two-thirds of the votes to win. In the first vote, Van Buren won the most support, but not two-thirds. The convention delegates voted again, and again Van Buren fell short. The delegates kept voting, but Van Buren never earned the number of votes he needed. In fact, Van Buren began to lose votes. Other candidates were suggested, but none of them seemed able to win the necessary two-thirds either. Finally, someone proposed a new name, James Knox Polk.
James Polk was a very fascinating man, very hardworking, relentless in his pursuit of goals. He was not a particularly likable human being. He was somewhat suspicious of other people, but he had a way of figuring out what he needed to do to accomplish what he wanted to accomplish, and he was very good at it, and that served him very well throughout his life.
Historian Robert Merry wrote a book about James K. Polk. Mr. Merry says Polk did not come to the 1844 convention expecting to be nominated for president. At the time, Polk's political career was struggling. He had already served as the Speaker of the U.S. House of Representatives and the Governor of Tennessee. He was well respected and serious. But Polk had lost in his attempts to seek re-election as governor not once, but twice. Polk came to the Democrats' convention hoping to re-enter national politics and perhaps win the nomination for vice president. When the convention delegates voted on their presidential candidate for the eighth time, Polk received only 44 votes. Then the delegates voted again. This time, Polk received all 266 votes. Historian Robert Merry says James K. Polk became the first real political dark horse in American history. In other words, he was someone no one thought would win. One reason he did was Texas. Polk wanted to make Texas a state. He thought the United States could take possession of the area peacefully. The other leading Democratic candidate, Martin Van Buren, did not think so. Neither did the Whig candidate, Henry Clay. Van Buren and Clay believed that annexation of Texas could lead to a war with Mexico, and they were afraid that if Texas were to become a state, Americans would clash again over the issue of slavery. So, Robert Merry says, both Martin Van Buren and Henry Clay spoke against bringing Texas into the Union.
And that was probably the right position from a standpoint of prudence, political prudence, or maybe diplomatic prudence. But it was the wrong position from the standpoint of where the American people were politically at that time.
In the 1840s, many Americans liked the idea of expanding the country. They believed in manifest destiny, the idea that God wanted America to expand west all the way to the Pacific Ocean and dominate the continent.
It's a very powerful concept, and it was not just a powerful concept, but it was a powerful impulse of America at that time.
As a result, Robert Merry says, many voters supported James K. Polk and his promise to add Texas to the United States. Polk took another unusual position in the 1844 election. He said if he won the presidency, he would serve only one term, that is, 4 years. Polk told voters he did not believe the federal government should have too much power. He said presidents and other elected officials might abuse their power if they held office too long. One term, he said, would be enough for him. But historian Robert Merry says there was more to Polk's one-term promise. After all, two presidents Polk admired, Andrew Jackson and Thomas Jefferson, had each served 2 terms. The nation's first president, George Washington, had also served 2 terms. Robert Merry says Polk's one-term promise was also a political bet. Polk wanted other Democratic politicians to support him. Polk thought that if he said he would be president for only 1 term, other politicians might help him win. Then those politicians could try again to win the presidency in 4 years instead of waiting 8.
And I suspect that he was probably right. And given the closeness of the election, I suspect that had he not made that one-term promise, he very likely would have been beaten by Clay.
As it was, the election of 1844 was extremely close. Wild campaign charges were made against both candidates. The Whig candidate, Henry Clay, was called a gambler, a duelist, a man of dishonest deals. Stories were told about his use of strong language and love of card games. On the other side, Whig newspapers reported that someone saw a group of slaves being sold in Tennessee. Burned into the skin of each slave, the papers said, were the letters JKP, the initials of James K. Polk. In the autumn of 1844, 2,700,000 Americans elected a new president. Polk defeated Clay by only about 38,000 votes nationwide. But Polk won 170 electoral votes to Clay's 105. President Tyler believed Polk's victory showed the American people wanted Texas to become a state. When Congress met in December, he proposed that both the House of Representatives and the Senate resolve to give Texas statehood. In a few months, they did. President Tyler signed the resolution on March 1, 1845, just 3 days before he left office. The resolution invited Texas to join the Union as a state. It gave Texas the right to split into as many as 4 more states when its population was large enough. Texas could keep its public lands, but it had to pay its own debts. And Texas could enter the Union as a slave state. The Mexican minister to the U.S. objected to the resolution. Mexico did not recognize Texas as an independent territory. The minister said making Texas an American state was an act of aggression against his country. He demanded his passport and returned to Mexico. Britain and France also sought to prevent Texas from becoming a state. They persuaded Mexico to agree to recognize Texas independence, but only if Texas would not join the United States. Texas thus had 2 choices. It could join the United States, or it could continue as a republic with its independence recognized by Mexico. The Texas Congress chose statehood. But the choice would come with a cost. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.